Hi, I'm Jeff Cross, and this is the Jeff Cross Show on Modern Web. We've got a special guest tonight, Jaafar Hussain from Quickster. Cut. Jaafar Hussain from Netflix will be joining us to talk about some of the projects he's been working on. So let's welcome him.
Jeff.
Jaafar, nice to see you. So, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The first Jeff show, actually.
That's an honor.
And last, maybe. So you and I have been best friends for how long?
Going on 20 years.
20 years now. But I'm actually a little bit embarrassed that I don't really know your beginnings. I know the projects you work on now. And I don't remember where I was 20 years ago. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you ended up working on all the things you're working on now? Where does it start?
Probably the track that got me here started when I was working about Microsoft, I'd say about 7 years ago. It's really the beginnings of like the work I've been doing on Falcor.
Mm-hmm. There. What were you doing at Microsoft?
I was working on a Silverlight toolkit, which was a really fun, cool project. I was lucky enough to be like the worst guy on the team.
Mm-hmm.
With some amazing, amazing developers. Hi guys. Hi Jeff. Hi Ted. They I learned a lot from them. It was really kind of a fast-paced environment, but it was a really unusual kind of team. Back in the day, Microsoft didn't really do open source. They're all about open source nowadays, but back then we did our shared source, which was a little bit different than open source. It was like Microsoft's, what they felt comfortable with at the time, where we wrote code and we kind of like open sourced it, so to speak, but we didn't really accept contributions back. So
it was licensed as open source, and you could see the code.
It was shared source. We had a shared source, and so that was very cool at Microsoft. You know, you didn't get a lot of that at the time, and I think that really got me, you know, kind of used to working in open source, and so that's why I've been so excited to do the Falcor open source thing here at Netflix. These six years later.
So then how did you go from Microsoft to Netflix?
Let's see.
Or why did you go?
You know, I mean, I thought Silverlight, I learned a lot from UI development from Silverlight. It's a really great framework. But didn't really think it was going to be the future of the web. So at some point, you know, maybe
Flash really killed it, huh?
I think it was Steve Jobs that killed it.
I guess so.
Right? So, you know, then I thought, well, gee, I think this internet fad is here to stay. So I thought I'd get into HTML5 JavaScript coding, and so.
So you moved down here to work at Netflix. Is that right?
I did. I moved from Seattle to work at Netflix. I miss Seattle. It's rainy, but it's a very nice city. You should go check it out sometime. But San Francisco is great too.
So I know you are big into functional reactive programming, and you're big in the ReactiveX project, which we use on Angular as well. Can you, for people, so FRP, functional reactive programming, this is a really overloaded term. Like, it means lots of different things to different people. In less than 2 hours, how would you describe what it actually means?
So honestly, that one's a tough one, because as you said, it is a really overloaded term. I'll tell you. And there are some people out there who would absolutely hate if we referred to observable, which is the type you guys are using in Angular, as functional reactive programming. So what I will do is I will put that loaded term aside, and I will just try and explain simply what an observable is. Now, I think most people out there, actually maybe not everybody, there's a lot of JavaScript developers out there who've never heard of an iterator before, but if you use a lot of ES6 or Babel, then, you know, iterators are coming. Iterator is this concept of, like, you know, I can ask some collection, for example, like an array for an iterator, and I can pull a value out one at a time until finally the iterator says, no more data. Now, a lot of people are familiar with that. That's been around in like computer science for a long, long time now. The Design Patterns book, which is like 20 years old, talked about it. But it's interesting. We can sort of take that, this role play, and we can like turn it the other way around, which is that instead of me asking you for an iterator and then requesting values progressively one by one, what I can do is I can hand you an observer, which is something that can accept. It's like sort of like three callbacks, right? Well, something that can accept a value, accept an error, and accept a message saying when it's done. Because just like with an iterator, you can tell me, hey, I've got no more values for you. An observable needs to be able to do the same thing. So it's sort of like I hand you an observer, which is a package of three callbacks, and then you push values at me by calling my callbacks. And so I get my data in the argument position of a callback, whereas normally with functions, we get our data returned in the return position of the function. And so that's kind of the difference between push and pull. And in the case of an observable, you can push multiple values and then finally say, I'm done, or deliver me an error.
Oh, now I get it. I didn't get it before, but...
You're just getting it now.
Yeah, I've been working on implementing it, but okay. You remember when you came to Google? I don't know how long ago it was. Maybe a year ago.
I think it's been like, yeah, man, it's been a long time.
You came.
Time flies.
Yeah, I guess it probably was the end of last year. You came and you talked to me and a couple other people from the Angular team, and you wanted to convince us that that we should be using observables in Angular 2, and that we should start looking at this as the primary async primitive. What was your favorite thing about that meeting?
My favorite thing about that meeting was that Misko was, he's great at playing devil's advocate, so he basically like hammered me completely for like, I would say probably at least an hour. He was just like hammering me on it, and I think maybe at the end I kind of convinced him a little bit. But.
Yeah, I remember we had, I think it was like a 1 or 2 hour meeting we had scheduled, and you had a series of points you wanted to establish to make your case, and we never got past the first point.
Yeah, I think so. I think like Misko just took the conversation in a totally different direction.
So what was the premise? It was that vector inputs are always, you should always have vector inputs for functions, never scalars, and it's a simpler world if you think of everything this way, right?
Yeah, I think it's easier if you think of, and I think there's a lot of devs out there who are, a lot of JavaScript developers who are now really familiar with promises, and promises are definitely better than callbacks, right? We know that. We don't have to deal with callback hell, and promises do error forwarding for us, just like try-catch. So those are great things about promises. But promises have some limitations. For one thing, they don't make add event listener or remove event listener any better. And add event listener or remove event listener, or sometimes what's called the event target interface, is a terrible interface. And I think most of the people, you know, certainly folks out there who are working in the web standards bodies would acknowledge this. It's not a very nice interface to work with. And of course, UI developers are working with this interface all the time. Every single time we want to listen to events, which are ubiquitous in UIs, we've got to deal with this interface. And observable.
I just use jQuery.
Use jQuery, right? Which is slightly better. With observable, you've got a primitive that's actually much better for modeling these streams of data. Mm-hmm. And one can argue that's also even better for modeling UI data requests or things like, you know, XML HTTP requests or network requests, which typically...
Which I argue that. I took a lot of flack for that in the Angular 2 HTTP library.
Yes. And, you know, it's understandable. Promises are popular, and they've got a lot of advantages, but I think there are two sort of flaws about using promises heavily in user interfaces. And that is, one is promises can't be canceled. There are people looking at trying to change that, but it's not a very easy thing to do. There's a lot of promises out there in the wild, and most of the strategies around promise cancellation involve like all of a sudden having the promise resolved to reject to an error, for example. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a little bit difficult to do when you've got all these promises in the wild where people don't really expect them to reject arbitrarily, right? Mm-hmm. There's no super great solution that I've certainly seen out there, although people are trying. So that's one problem, which is that, you know,
Is it being baked into the spec though, cancellation? I've seen discussion for fetch because they don't because they need promises for canceling requests.
Yes, I think the fetch API, which is so, for those who don't know, the fetch API is like a really nice, think of it as a much shorter, more developer-friendly way of doing XML HTTP requests. Mm-hmm. So right now, if you've ever done XML HTTP requests, you notice it requires a huge amount of ceremony. Very few people actually use the API directly. We go through a helper method like jQuery or something. But you know what the folks, what the web standards guys did is they sort of designed this really nice, helpful shorthand method called fetch, right? Mm-hmm. Why should we have to use frameworks to do this? And it returned a promise. And one of the downsides there is that we lost something that we had in XML HTTP request, which was the notion of abort. Mm-hmm. So you can abort an XML HTTP request. And that can sometimes, in some cases, if you've got, say, for example, requests pending and buffered up, you can actually keep it from making a request if you are in the user interface and you no longer need that request. And you know, furthermore, and that could be good for two reasons. One, you can actually avoid kicking off an HTTP request. The second is you might have something associated with that XML HTTP request ending, like you had a bunch of code you want to run when the data request is done. Well, you don't have to like make a state machine to sort of remember that, oh yeah, I canceled this thing. And so I think the core problem with using promises in modern UI frameworks is that promises are kind of predicated on the idea, it's why it's called a promise, that once you make this request, it's absolutely going to finish and it's going to end. And I don't think that really reflects the reality of most user interfaces. Because the thing about users is that they're fickle. They open up forms and they see the loading bar and they get bored and then they hit the X button. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they'll start entering information in a form and then they'll just hit cancel. Mm-hmm. Or they'll ask you to start playing a movie and then they'll go to another page. And all of these things, you know, developers, ideally, we should be able to sort of treat these very realistic occurrences, not as exceptions, exceptional things that are very rarely going to happen, but we should be able to treat them in a way where we expect them to happen, and we don't have to work very, very hard to keep the UI from doing the wrong thing in those situations. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things Observable has going for it. It's not just a promise that can call you multiple times, it's lazy, in the sense that when you nothing happens with most observables until you subscribe to them, mm-hmm. and then when you subscribe to them, you get back this little subscription object and be your way of saying, hey, I don't care about the result of this anymore. And that's not the same as canceling. That's just you saying, you know what? I don't need this result. Mm-hmm. Now, the observable can see that nobody's listening and can decide, you know, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's around to hear it, I might as well, you know, it has no effect. And, mm-hmm. and then it can decide to cancel an underlying network request, but there's no guarantee of that. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you know, we have a way of modeling this very common behavior of users changing their mind.
Yep. And that's the design we've adopted with the Angular 2 HPE is when you do unsubscribe, then it puts the XHR request and obviously we need the follow-up work. So I should have time boxed that question.
That answer.
Did I put you against the
think hour? That I think we're past 2 hours now, so we've got to cut this short. But well, I think maybe we can just edit it down in post. Yeah. So it's a promise. It's in the browser now. Is that a good thing? Promises are good. Does it make it where the experience for developers is good enough that they don't need to go further and have something as powerful as an observable because they've freed themselves from callbacks? In terms of getting observable push through, do you think it helps or hurts that promise is now in the spec?
You know, I don't think it hurts. I think most people recognize that, you know, vectors and scalars are different, that promise is not really a good enough way of modeling event target, which is, as I said, like this ubiquitous API at Eventless or Movement Listener that we all have to deal with in browsers. I think promises are good in the sense that, honestly, I think of them as a stepping stone to better asynchronous abstractions, and that's useful, right? As we said, they're better than callbacks, but they do have their downsides, and I think they've got some gotchas. Like, if you think about the three most common operations in a user interface, it's events, which promises don't do a really good job of modeling for aforementioned reasons, right? Async requests, and we already talked about the challenges of using promises for async requests. You can't cancel them, right? You have to, and in the case that you reject them as an error, you have to sort of like treat it as a special error so you know it's not a real error, but it's a cancellation error, and then that means you have to set up a state machine to like, you know, say, oh yeah, by the way, I canceled.
Yeah, I know.
Not fun, right? And then even think about things like your typical async API out there, like there's some very common async APIs in the browser, like set timeout. You can cancel a set timeout, mm-hmm. right? You can even some animations, you can sort of like stop, right? And so the problem of modeling these things as promises is they don't really reflect, mm-hmm. you know, what I think happens in most user interfaces.
Yep. And I love promises. Don't get me wrong.
Right. Nobody hates promises, as I said. You got an abstraction that's better than callbacks. And if you happen to find yourself in the situation where you're making an async request and it's going to resolve. Or, for example, another good example of where, you know, promises, I think, make a lot more sense than user interfaces is in Node. I think in Node where, you know, sending out a promise and just letting it drop on the floor, if on a timeout, for example, or, you know, it's not the end of the world if you make a lot of HTTP requests in Node because they're not precious resources like they are in a browser where you have only a few HTTP requests that you can make to a particular domain at any time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at things like async await, right, they're great for those scenarios.
Cool. So you're on TC39, the committee that works on the JavaScript spec, the ECMAScript spec, as you guys like to call it. ECMAScript 2016 is in progress. Is there an actual ECMAScript 2016? Is there anything agreed on that's going to?
So the way that TC39 works is that we've got a stage system where, and it's not unlike, you know, training. It's not like the way we do software development. In fact, that's one of the big innovations we've had around the specification for the new version of JavaScript. Now it's just features move through these stages, at which point there's checkpoints. There's, you know, like we make sure every single individual stage has a certain gate for getting out of. Mm-hmm. And whatever's ready, like stage 5, by the end of the year, that's what makes it into the language. And so there's a bunch of really exciting features that are moving through the language. I don't think anything's quite reached stage 5 yet, mm-hmm. but I think there's a couple of features that are very likely to make it in there.
Does it have to be at a committee meeting you all agree and decide on it, or do you do a lot of work offline and have meetings
typically,
where you could agree on?
In my experience, typically there's a flurry of activity the week before the committee meeting. This is, we've all got jobs, we're all really busy, and so people tend the mind focuses about a week or 2 weeks before the committee meeting, mm-hmm. and a lot of work gets done. And in general, we try and very often that at the meeting is where we sort of agree to move things forward as a feature. It's a committee process, and so generally we seek consensus, you mm-hmm. know, and I think for the most part, you know, that's not a problematic process. It's a slow moving process.
Is there anything in stage five right now ready to go for?
I don't think we've got anything in stage five. I could be wrong. I might have to look that one up. But
it was the last committee meeting of the year just last week?
I think it was the last of the year, yeah. It was just in November, yeah, last week or the week before.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So observables, you're working on getting observable in the spec,
yeah.
You and some other folks.
Yes.
What's the state on that? Are there parts of the spec that are changing a lot? Do people agree? Is there opposition to getting it in?
You know, I think we went through a lot of changes, but a lot of it was, I won't say cosmetic because that makes it sound less important. Some of the changes I think were really, really good for ergonomics, and so there was a lot of flurry of interest and activity. I think the specification is somewhat stabilized now. We're not sort of seeing, you know, a lot of changes to it. And I mean, I think it's very similar to the core observable that most people who've worked with things like RxJS or Bacon, you're going to think most of the any changes are pretty cosmetic. And the stage is currently at is stage one, which is actually it's the second stage because of course it's stage zero, everything's base zero, mm-hmm. We're looking at moving it forward. But one of the things the committee is doing right now is we're trying to come up with a story for asynchrony in JavaScript. We want to be able to give the right primitives so that we can talk to standards bodies, and they end up picking the right thing. And so what the committee has basically told us is they want to advance not just observable, but because observable can't do everything. There's things like I/O, which require some back pressure, uh-huh. right? So rather than just advance observable, and then they're a little concerned that I think what web standards bodies or web standard, you know, the folks writing web standards might take observable where it's not really applicable. They want to basically provide options for the full range mm-hmm. of possibilities in async programming all at the same time. So what we're doing is we're looking at advancing asynchronous iterator for things like IO. So it's like a new async generator for, you know, for those, you know, generators. It's sort of like a generator with promises. And then observable potentially for things like event target.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I know you've done some work already with seeing how observable fits in with some of these new proposals. What do you think the timeline is for actually getting to consensus or some more proofing out what you want it to look like?
Well, I think that as I said, the proposal is relatively stable at the moment. I think the question now is, I think the committee's made it pretty clear they want to see these solutions move forward in lockstep. And so now we're actually kind of turning our efforts towards asynchronous iterator, or it's actually kind of up in the air. Asynchronous iterator will be the right type for IO. I suspect it probably will be the right choice that people use for IO. And so we're kind of focusing in on moving that proposal forward so that we can move observable and that proposal forward in lockstep. And Kevin Smith is working, or Zen Parsing on GitHub, mm-hmm. as you know.
That's his real name, Kevin Smith. Yeah, Kevin Smith, I just yes. know Zen Parsing is GitHub.
Kevin's a really sharp guy, and he's actually already done a lot of work on async, mm-hmm. The asynchronous iterator. In fact, he has a transpiler that has async function star, and so the idea would be that an async function star might return an asynchronous iterator. Mm. And so he's got a nice prototype out there, and we're looking at kind of moving that into the standard.
Does Babel have support for this?
Not yet. It's way too early. We haven't.
They seem pretty aggressive, though, or pretty ambitious, adventurous.
They're great. I mean, they're great. As soon as stuff moves into stages, you often see it in Babel. But at this point, it's not even a stage zero proposal. So at the next meeting, our goal right now, Kevin and I, is to move that to stage zero.
Without going too far down the CC39. Yeah. Function binding is an interesting feature, and I know Ben told me you were talking about it with some other folks on CC39 recently. The nice syntax where you can have left to right binding functions to context.
Yeah, for those of you out there who don't like typing function or this dot function bind this, there's two kind of hybrid proposal out there that's really, I mean, would be really, really nice. One is the bind operator where you can put colon colon on the left-hand side of, so like I could say, some object dot method, and then I could put colon colon on the left-hand side of the object, and then I would effectively get a function that's bound. And so no more object.function.bindObject. And so that's one half of the proposal. And that's, I think, relatively uncontroversial. I think most people are tired of that, and I think the committee would really like to see that. That's very ergonomic. But one other feature that, you know, I think a lot of people want, but is challenging to do right, is the ability to call some function that's just floating around in scope, right, as if it was a member of an object. So I can just go object :: some method, and then basically it's as if that method is attached on the prototype chain of this object, even though it's not, even though it's just sort of floating in scope. And that's really nice, because one of the things about JavaScript is that it's this hybrid programming language, right? It's object-oriented, but it's also functional. Mm-hmm. And right now, object-oriented can sometimes be a little more ergonomic, and that's not good if the thing you should be doing in certain cases is functional. This is one of the strengths of JavaScript, that we can apply the right paradigm for the right problem. And so if the problem's a functional programming problem, right, sometimes we kind of have to do backflips to call functions. Basically, the bottom line is we want to write code left to right. I want to say object.method.method.method, and that's really tough if, you know, you're not kind of using the prototype chain. All you've got is functions accepting objects. And so that's the goal of the bind operator, to be able to let you call it in that way.
Yep. Yeah, and it's especially exciting for observable.
Right.
I think Ben told you, and you saw, and you rained on our parade of how we wanted to solve this problem, but we want to have, so observable RxJS, it comes with all these combinators. I don't know how many there are, something like 100 maybe.
A huge number of combinators,
And you don't want to, we want to have a light bundle size, a light payload. We don't have to include all these combinators, but we still want observables to be powerful in the browser. So this makes it nice, where we can just import like map as a function, and then we could say observable :: map.
Exactly.
Without having to ship all these observables.
I mean, this is a big hole in the language, because without this, truly there are no good ways of doing this. I mean, there's only bad options, and slightly less bad options. Mm-hmm. And so I really hope that the committee addresses this feature one way or another. There's other, you know, earlier proposals that, like, you know, in the earlier stages or even just in the conceptual stage, that could propose even better approaches to this. But I think it is one of the big holes in JavaScript at the moment. I think, you've got this, I think, very flexible hybrid programming language. But unfortunately, when you start getting into functional programming and doing exactly the type of things you're doing with observable, and this could benefit, you know, Lodash. There's lots of frameworks out there that do this type of composition, right? It's not really object oriented, but you want to call it left. It's function composition, but you want to call it left to right. And so there's a lot. It's not just Rx. Lots of frameworks would benefit from this. And so I hope the committee can come to agreement on a solution. And I hope there's a lot of enthusiasm, because I can tell you I'm very enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, me too. So speaking of observable and Rx, you've been involved with ReactiveX for some time, right?
Right,
I'm curious. So I just came in. I've always heard of ReactiveX and Rx, but never really used it. But in the past couple of years, I've been really getting into it and adopting it more. What's the history behind that? Or how did that get started? Where did it come from? And how did we get here with all these different Rx implementations and all these different languages?
Actually, that's why I called, harken back to Microsoft when I said what led me here. When I was working at Microsoft, it really wasn't the Silverlight toolkit that led me here, I would say, to Netflix. It was, I joined Microsoft because I was really excited about what Microsoft was doing in the space of functional programming. Mm-hmm. Back in 2008 or so, when I joined, 2009, they just released C# 3.5, I think, was the version. But what was so interesting about that is that they'd introduced these functional programming features directly into the language. And I, you know, at the time I was working in more of like line of business apps type of thing. And I was kind of surprised by how much plumbing there was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was taking data out of a database, I was loading them into objects, and then I was sending it over the wires XML. And that's really what my job was again and again. I spent so much time plumbing. Right, I mean, somebody's got to do it, right? Mm-hmm. That's a line of business app. It's a huge amount of it's just CRUD. But it was just shockingly difficult. And I remember reading a paper at some point by a man named Eric Meyer called Circles, Triangles, and Squares. And I was like, it really caught my eye, like the name of the paper, Circles, Triangles, and Squares. And as I read through, it was just like, most developers spend most of their time converting data from a representation of squares, i.e. database tables, to circles, objects, and then eventually to triangles. And that's XML. And if we just put features into the programming language to make that easy, right? The problem was, the reason why it was hard is, like, object-oriented programming has these impedance mismatches with SQL, which has these impedance mismatches with XML. And if we just brought these basic features into the language instead of trying to make C# a strictly object-oriented programming language, all of a sudden we could take out a lot of that friction. And it turned out that the solution of those problems was bringing a lot of functional programming primitives into the language. But what was so brilliant about it was that I had no idea I was doing functional programming. Yeah. I was like, what I thought was I was writing SQL in my code. And it felt great, it looked great. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, what and sure enough, when those features made their way into the C# language, it was a lot of it was based on Eric's work, Eric Meyer.
Link,
yes, language integrated query. Absolutely. Okay. And it totally changed my outlook on programming. By that point, I had been programming for, you know, a long time, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was pretty good. And it was one of those great experiences when you learn something and you realize, wow, I'm terrible. You know, I'm really not good. I don't know, there's a huge amount of in this industry that I don't know yet. And so, sorry, to make a very long story short, Eric, when I got there, Eric had, without knowing me, trained me to think increasingly about everything as this stream of data that I was transforming. So instead of thinking in terms of loops, I was thinking in terms of queries. And so I made some excuse to, maybe I accidentally ran into him in the halls, and just I wanted to show him something that I'd worked on and introduce myself. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he introduced me to this thing called Link to Events. And it turned out that just like I could transform streams of data like files, or I could transform data in in-memory collections, Eric had figured out that I could transform events that the exact same way. So I just spent the last 2-3 years learning how to think of everything as queries over streams, and then Eric comes along and says, and just completely blows my mind and says, you know what? Events are streams of data too. And so here, before I'd been able to use this in just certain corners of my code, but as soon as I got in my UI, everything was very callback based. It's pretty much the callback hell that most JavaScript developers experience today. Mm-hmm. But as soon as he showed me that, I realized that I can use functional programming everywhere in my application. Mm-hmm. I can use this simple declarative language.
I went totally crazy.
I mean, it's just like any new technology, yeah, right? You push it too far. You gotta go too far to push it to the edges to figure out where the edges are, mm-hmm. right? But it was fantastic, and I think, you know, the JavaScript community a couple of years later was going through the same thing, and I was able to look around and recognize, hey, wait a minute, you guys have got the same problem that I just sort of got through. Microsoft has fantastic technology for this, and they released RxJS, mm-hmm. which was after the one version for C#, they released RxJS, I was able to convince Eric to open source that. He was working diligently inside of Microsoft. Again, this is before Microsoft's come to Jesus moment, their conversion about open source, and so that was a tough thing to do. But Netflix was, I'd probably worked at Netflix about a week before I pitched RX. Partly because...
To Netflix.
Uh-huh. And I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't because I was dying to use RX. It was because, just like everyone back then, you know, this is like 3-4 years ago, we were all suffering from the same problems. We had Netflix had 100,000 lines of code of JavaScript, mm-hmm. and they just had callback hell like everybody else did, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at different options. We were looking at promise libraries, but I think we ended up going with Observable for a lot of the, you know, things I mentioned earlier. And so in many ways, my leaving Microsoft was an attempt, actually, in a funny way, to actually use RX. Mm-hmm. Because Microsoft hasn't always been the best company at using the technology that comes out of its research and development. And I think I'm not the only one to level that criticism. I think it's gotten much better in that area. It's getting better in that area. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you know, this was fantastic work coming out of R&D. I was super excited about it. It was difficult to use at work, and so that's part of the reason why I left Microsoft. It wasn't just to get into JavaScript and HTML. It was to really see how hard and far I could push reactive programming, not just on the client, but on the server.
So around that time, were C# and RxJS the only implementations of React?
Yeah, around when I left, I think they were, I don't want to say only, somebody might have ported it to like F# or something, but it wasn't widely a known technology. Mm-hmm. And so when I got here, we started using RX. I think I'd pitched it pretty early, and I think we finally started getting around to using it maybe 6 months in. Mm-hmm. And I think it spread through the code base pretty quickly. And then it became clear that, you know, we had some of the same problems on the server side. I came in at a really fortuitous time in Netflix because they were in the process of kind of reimagining how the client and server would talk to each other. And it's like, these big technology transitions don't happen every day, so I was really lucky to be a part of it, lucky to be there at the time. And they were like, well, we have this problem. We want to give client developers the ability to write server scripts, but you know, it was a Java environment, and we certainly don't want them worrying about threading. Yep. We certainly don't want them worrying about locks, right? That was just a no-go, right? Nobody wants to wake up in the middle of the night and find out that the server's down and have to be on pager duty. And
there's no global window to attach everything.
Absolutely, right? And they were like, well, these JavaScript developers, what can they handle? What do they know? Well, they know callbacks, right? So let's give them, and I think they made absolutely the right call here, where they said, look, let's make everything asynchronous. Let's make all of our APIs a callback API. And I was here, I think, you know, I was here at the right time to influence that process to some degree, and I sort of...
So were you as charismatic back then as you are today?
despite my charisma, I was able to get this done. And I think it was actually the fact that, you know, here we've got incredibly forward-thinking developers. I mean, it's not every day that you can go into a Java shop and say, hey, by the way, I've got this great Microsoft technology that you should build your next system on. And to their credit, I mean, you know, our developers here are... they're looking for the right solution. And I got healthy pushback. I got healthy pushback as well they should, coming in with technology that was still, as I said, not really widely, you know, people weren't talking a lot about reactive programming. It was on the margins. Nowadays, you can't go to a conference and not hear about reactive programming. But, you know, 3 years ago, it wasn't on the tip of everybody's tongue necessarily. And yeah. So
JavaScript especially, I think React is, you know, whether or not it's pure reactive, functional reactive programming or not, but it's helped to popularize a lot of these ideas.
Absolutely.
Of purity.
Absolutely.
And immutability.
And I mean, I think, you know, Ben Christensen, who I think he's now at Facebook, actually, but he was big, really. He deserves most of the credit, by far, most of the credit. And some folks like George Campbell, I don't want to leave anybody out, for porting Rx to Rx Java. And so we built an in-house Java version of Rx, which is, I think, one of our, if not the most, one of our most popular open source projects. And it's actually... now, the work that we did here on Reactive Streams, which is called, we call it Reactive Streams, mm-hmm. is now, I think it's on track for standardization in Java. And so these ideas are actually making their way now all the way into the Java framework. And so it's a testament to Eric's work. Eric actually did help us out. We worked with Eric on the framework, and you know, it's just now most of our server code is on the server side and on the client side is written in Rx. So when you make a request to Netflix, you're going through at least two observables there in two different environments as you go through the network.
Cool. You know, I got an email from Eric once.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, oh, Eric Meyer is emailing me. But the only reason was because someone asked him to review or asked him about my HTTP implementation in Angular 2 and said, do you think a promise or an observable is better to map a request and response? And Eric just replied and said, well, I guess a promise is better since it's just a one-off thing. And so the guy included me on the thread and said, see, Eric Meyer, who knows more than anybody else on the subject, says that observables are not the right primitive for this, so you're wrong. But it's funny because Eric, of all people, would say, like, don't trust him without the context and you know, don't take him at his word, but think for yourself. But anyway, so I felt special anyway.
That, yes.
At least in some regard, I was on his radar.
Well, reasonable people can disagree, right, Eric?
So I talked to Kim, your boss. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Ben as well. I talked to Ben all the time. And I was like, you know, what does Joffre do? Like, what's it like working with them? And what I hear from everybody is that you just roam the halls of Netflix thought leading all day. So the question is, do you actually know how to code?
That is a good question. It's been a little while.
I thought maybe we could have a chance to do some coding interview questions. could we bring a whiteboard in? And
All right. Let's do this.
Okay. We'll just do some simple JavaScript questions. Actually, I've got one easy one here. So this should be a pretty easy one. It's a simple function called log. Above it, we're declaring the adjective variable, giving it a value of electric. And then we're calling log after it's done. And inside the function, we just console log. And then we're redeclaring adjectives. So the question is, what actually gets logged to the console in this?
I'll have to remember my string coercion rule. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say Joffre has an undefined personality because, of course, this variable gets lifted, and so it's declared here, which means it it masks this variable, but it'll be undefined because the initialization won't happen until down here.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's accurate too. I'm just kidding. Okay, good. Good start. Let's do.
Are we done?
No. We've got a couple more. Let's try. Show me how to add two numbers together.
How to add two numbers together. All right.
Yeah, feel free.
Should I write?
Yeah, let's write it down.
Or should I? Are these numbers in scope? Are they constant?
That's a great question. Let's just do literals.
Literals. Okay. How do I add two numbers together? I'm gonna do this now. Should I assign this to a variable? Because this is an expression.
That's a good question.
I'm gonna do it anyway. I'm gonna go. And I can't forget my semicolon, of course.
So the implementation is correct, but you didn't ask what the values of the numbers should be. And so in a real interview, I'd be forced to deduct points.
I see. Okay.
But, you know, some partial credit. So, okay, let's do another one.
All right.
Write a function that will return true for even number inputs.
For even numbered inputs. Mm-hmm. All right.
Function?
I'm sorry about my serial killer handwriting here. Okay. So you said return true for even numbered inputs, right?
That's right.
Okay, let's see if. So I'm going to write return true here because you just told me to return true for even numbered inputs. I think I could return false there, but I'm just going to be very specific.
That's not fair.
You've seen this one before. Okay, that's correct too. Okay, now let's do an algorithm.
Oh no.
Write a search algorithm that will crawl the internet.
Can we get another whiteboard?
Yeah. Use as much space sometimes. It'll crawl the internet and implement a data structure that will have an O1 lookup time.
An O1 lookup
for a billion queries to match them with a result, the best result.
Am I size
ranked
bound
by relevance? No.
No, so no size bound.
Mm-hmm. It needs to be shardable though.
It needs to be shardable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see where to begin. Okay, shall I turn this around?
Yeah, sure. You're actually going to.
We're going to have to cut this.
Just give up.
Okay, I give up.
It's impossible. I could do it. I've seen the code.
I'm no Jeff Cross.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's okay. I'm convinced. I'll tell Kim. She'll be glad to hear it. Well, speaking of Angular 2, we've got to take a commercial break now to hear from one of our sponsors.
I would say that Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Super excited about it.
So the project you're working on, I think you spend most of your time on now, is Falcor, right?
Actually, you know what? Yeah, I would say that's accurate. Yeah.
Okay. Why Falcor? Why do we need another data library?
Another data fetching library. Well, you know, I don't think there's that many. I mean, what I mean is that's not fair. There's a lot of data fetching libraries out there.
There are more frameworks than there are data libraries.
Yeah. I mean, I think the core problem we had was that you know, when we built Netflix, we were trying to, actually around that time that I talked about, where we were looking at revamping the way the client and server talk to each other, we sort of looked at what our core problem was, and one of the core problems was that we wanted to retain as much information in the cache as possible when you're going through Netflix, because frankly, Netflix is mostly a browsing problem. It's just a bunch of static data for the most part, right? Of course, the catalog changes, but during the average time where a user is interacting with Netflix, the catalog isn't changing a lot. And so we would, you know, benefit pretty heavily from caching. And so the kind of the obvious architecture for those people who, you know, you ever used a web browser is REST. I think there's a lot of talk about using REST and a lot of, you can find lots of guides out there, people happy to tell you how to build a RESTful API. But I think what gets lost in a lot of that conversation is that REST was kind of originally designed with things like web pages in mind. I mean, the idea was that REST was kind of extracted as a set of architectural principles, extracted from what worked about the World Wide Web. And, you know, it works really well when you're browsing web pages, right? Static web pages, images. If you go to an average web page, you might download a couple of large resources, right? I mean, maybe a big bunch of JavaScript or a couple of images and then a document, right? Yep. And certainly back in the 90s, that's what the World Wide Web was, just browsing around and a couple of coarse-grained resources. But that's not really what web applications do. Mm-hmm. For the most part, web applications tend to deal with a large amount of small grained resources. And so I'll give you an example. Like, you open up Netflix and you take a look at the iPad, if you just swipe your hand, what you'll really see is, like, you know, 40, 50 to 100 resources go flying by. And most of them could be as small as this tiny little JSON object with the URL of a box shot that we pull down from a CDN.
Yep.
And that's not really what, you know, REST was kind of optimized for. I don't want to make an HTTP request, certainly, for each one of those individual JSON objects and then follow it up with another HTTP request to a CDN. And so the idea was REST has a lot of great principles, though. This idea of idempotence, like, you know, everything has a unique URL, and you always grab that information through this unique identifier, and that makes it really easy to cache, because that's a natural cache key, right? And so it has good ideas, and unfortunately, the machinery of HTTP, what we have at our disposal with HTTP, is designed for these coarse-grained resources instead of fine-grained resources, large amounts of fine-grained resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of, I would love to say that what actually happened was I you know, methodically took a look at REST and surveyed the different architectures out there and then condensed it into exactly the essence of what we needed. In fact, it was a lot more chaotic than that. I think did what most people do, is sort of organically engineer a solution of that problem. And then only, you know, later on realized that I was kind of rebuilding the ideas of REST.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I might have saved myself a little time had I realized that correspondence earlier. But that's, I mean, one way of thinking about Falcor is that we build REST, but instead of, you know, for these many resources spread across the World Wide Web,
mm-hmm.
we built REST for what most web applications, in my experience, really want, which is a JSON document. In fact, they would like to think of all of their model, all the data out there on the cloud, as a single JSON object.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's exactly how Falcor models your data.
Mm-hmm.
One JSON resource out there on the server. And you interact with it as if it was already on the client. And so you ask for the data using just plain old JavaScript paths. And then basically it gets sent to you asynchronously.
Mm-hmm. So the reading side of Falcor has always been intuitive to me. Like, the first time I saw it, it was okay. Like, the URL is a caching key, and the linking between objects, that was really, that seemed really interesting. The mutations of data are the part that I've never really followed. Like,
yeah.
How when I mutate data that came from the graph in my client, how does it persist back to the source, the server source, and also get propagated to whatever other clients are subscribed?
Good question. So, I mean, there's really two ways of mutating, and one's much simpler than the other in Falcor. One is set, and set is basically the equivalent of a put in HTTP, right? One of the great things about a put is that it's an idempotent operation, which means I can repeat it as many times as I can repeat it. If there's a failure in the network, I can just sort of retry without being concerned that I'm triggering any additional side effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea is I just have the ID, and then the resource that I want to replace whatever the resource is at that ID. And so we took that idea and we expressed it, you know, in JSON. What is that? Well, that's just setting a member, right? Setting a member on an object. And so we took the idea of put, but we made it idiomatic of what you do in JavaScript, which is we introduced a set operation in Falcor.
Mm-hmm.
And so set operations are great because, as I said, they can be retried, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? You can't use a put for everything. And a good example of that is adding something to a list, right? And that's why we have things like post. Now, posts are more problematic because they're non-idempotent operations, which means that if there's a failure, you can't just retry a post, because then you might end up adding two items to the list, right? So there are some operations which we want to do transactionally. In other words, I might want to change a whole bunch of different objects in the graph, but I want to make sure that it all happens or none of it happens, for example, right? And that's typically, you know, either you do a post, but another way people think about that typically is the other big architecture out there instead of REST for distributed systems is remote procedure calls. And I think that's in fact what I think a lot of web applications out there actually build. Even when they think they're building RESTful applications at some point, because of the aforementioned problems, they kind of give up. That's what Netflix did at certain, I think originally we had what we considered a RESTful API, and it was really on close inspection something much closer to an RPC.
I think probably 1% of RESTful implementations are probably not actually, or are probably actually REST.
Yeah, and I don't know what the figure is, but I can tell you, I mean, most of the APIs I've seen when I've asked developers, you know, I say, like, put your hand up if you got a RESTful API. And, you know, when I get an opportunity to look closely, you know, they're, let's say that they're not fully RESTful or they're not, you know, certainly there are, there are area where they're kind of just cheating. And often it's to get around these constraints, to get around these constraints of how do I get all this data down there to the client, and how do I basically get what I get out of RPC, which is I make one call to the server, I get all the data I need for this specific application scenario. Mm-hmm. And if you make procedures like that, they tend to be really very specific, right? Now, oh, like I want to add this one field to my view, so I got to go over to the server and change it. Mm-hmm. Now, call is there really as a way of taking the things about REST that are great and also taking the things about RPC that are great and combining them. So call is Falcor's way of doing transactional operations. And the challenge of mixing these two things, and people do tend to mix them. They'll do like a very RESTful looking kind of service, but then they'll include this other service, which is really just, you know, encoding a bunch of parameters as function parameters and invoking a function call. And that's really problematic because if you're relying on RESTful caching, as in your browser cache, for example, right, and then you hit some endpoint over here which changes a bunch of data on the server, well, then you've just made a bunch of data here stale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might be okay in some scenarios. We can deal with staleness of data if I'm, like, browsing the web, for example, maybe. Mm-hmm. But a lot of web applications cannot do that. For example, if you rate a title in Netflix, like House of Cards, and it's in the drama genre list, and then you scroll down, and maybe House of Cards is also technically considered a thriller, and it's sitting right there, and it doesn't reflect your rating, not good enough, right? Users demand more.
If that happened to me.
Exactly, right? Users demand more of web applications in many ways than they do of web pages, as well they should. Mm-hmm. And that's why we treat the caching different. That's why, for us, it's a priority to maintain this consistent cache. And the secret to how we do it is relatively straightforward, right? How do we have a cache which represents reality as close as we can get it, but then also operate and basically call a black box. A procedure, is a black box you invoke, and you know it makes a bunch of changes, and you have really no idea what those changes are because you don't know what it does. So how do you reconcile these two things? Well, when you call the procedure, it sends back to the client what parts of that JSON resource have actually been changed. It doesn't send the values because that might take a lot of time. It might send a lot of data. Instead, it just says, hey, what parts of the cache have been invalidated? And so that kicks it out of the client-side cache, and if you ask for that data again, you get it fresh from the server.
So there's no push concept with Falcor if there's a change from the server to push it to all the connected clients?
That's correct. There's no push out of the box, but I want to call out something, which is that in Falcor, you can always, on the client side, you can go in and invalidate the cache, the local cache. And I want to clarify, we don't use a browser cache, because what we basically have is one big JSON object out there on the server. Instead, our cache is just an in-memory cache of that JSON object, whatever parts we've downloaded before. So at any moment, if you were to crack open the Falcor model and take a look inside the cache, all you'd see was a partial representation of the JSON out there on the server. And so what we're doing is we're sort of purging it from there. But sorry, your question was again?
If there's a way to notify clients that are connected.
I mean, we don't have a way of, strictly speaking, of pushing. However, I mean, if you're fortunate enough to have some push mechanism, maybe you're on a mobile device, or maybe you have a WebSocket connection, mm-hmm. there's absolutely nothing stopping you whatsoever from sending data down, because Falcor allows you to directly write data into the cache. Mm-hmm. It also allows you to directly invalidate data from the cache. And so we haven't necessarily set up a push mechanism, mm-hmm. but that's something that if you have any kind of conduit, it's very easy for someone to just push data from the server down to the client to keep them in sync. We also have a timeout as well for the cache. So if you want to specify a timeout value for an individual value, just like HTTP, you can do that.
Cool. So we on Angular, we're really focusing on mobile and speed and latency and caching and all these things, making things smaller, reducing computation on clients. And offline is one part of that. Is there any reason why a Falcor cache couldn't be persisted beyond memory? Like if I wanted to implement my own, is it called a data source? Is that?
Yeah. So the way to think about it is, so your question is, you know, I mean, how can we use Falcor for offline?
If I would connect to a server that has, implements the model, the JSON model, and then on the client have a cache that is persisted in like local storage or IndexedDB, something like that. Is there anything fundamentally wrong with that, or could I do that?
No. In fact, it's relatively straightforward to do. In fact, any of the identity operations are going to be very, very easy to run offline, right? Because the way to think about it is you can ask Falcor at any time for a copy of its cache, and it's just JSON, so it's easy to write to local storage. And then you can load it anytime you want and load it right directly back into the Falcor model, and then basically just set it into the Falcor model. And the Falcor model is basically, it's what it sounds like. It's the model, the M in your MVC, right? And so it's your window into your data out there on the server. And the only difference between that and a normal model is that it's like it's got a JSON-like API. You pass in paths and you retrieve data. Mm-hmm. The only difference between that and a normal model is that it's asynchronous. So it returns you data in a promise or an observable. And the way to think about it is that a model is it needs to get access to JSON graph data. And I don't think I explained JSON graph, but it's basically a way of encoding a graph into JSON format. That's, you know, we've got our own way of encoding a graph into JSON. And it basically has an interface which it uses to access as a layer of indirection between it and the JSON graph data called the data source. And anybody who can implement a data source, so you can implement a data source to make that data available over a WebSocket instead of HTTP, or grab that data from WebWorker, or grab it from local storage. So it's just an interface that the Falcor model uses. Mm-hmm. And so certainly set and get are idempotent, so they're super easy to do offline. Mm-hmm. Call right now, we don't have a good solution for running offline, because the idea is that it's a black box that sort of runs on the server. Mm-hmm. We're looking at different options there, and what would make life a lot easier is that if you don't have, let me put it this way. Call is very often fundamentally about mutation, right? I want to go change these things. I want to change a lot of them. The best systems are. Let me put that differently. The easiest systems to reason about are the ones where you don't have mutation. And it's easy to imagine a system where, you know, every time you rated a video in Netflix, instead of going and changing some value in a database, we just created a new record, for example. Or every single time you added an item to your list, instead of just going and changing that list, we created a new list. And that makes systems actually much easier to sort of reason about, and we're exploring right now how to add primitives to the system to work with backends that are immutable. And so there's a couple of databases out there that are immutable, like Datomic is a great example in the Clojure world of immutable backend stores. Immutability just makes everything so easy because nothing ever changes, right? And so you could then perform a whole series of operations offline and then at any time sort of, you know, send them back up. And count on the fact that, you know, you didn't break anything, you don't have these race conditions to worry about. And so that we're thinking about adding an operation to Falcor called transform to make that efficient, because what we don't want is like, hey, I created this whole new object and maybe 90% of it's the same, but you have to download all 100% of it. And you might already have 90% of that same stuff in the cache.
Sure.
And so that's something we're exploring for an upcoming version of Falcor.
Is it true people at work call you Falcor?
No, they don't. They don't. But every now and then I can be seen roaming the halls in my sweet Falcor t-shirt, which I wish we had. I've gotten many compliments on the Falcor logo, which I did not design.
I think I've been promised a t-shirt a few times.
I'll make that. We can make that happen. I think they're right up there.
Okay, I got a sticker.
You got a sticker, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we can swing a. We might even be able to swap.
I can swap. I've got some stickers. I could swap for a t-shirt too.
You got an Angular sticker for
I've
me?
Got lots of
All right.
Stickers.
Well, then I'll hook you up with. I might even hook you up with a sweatshirt.
All right.
We reserve the sweatshirts for the for the inner sanctum.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
One of the first times I think the first time I met you, I came here to Netflix and you were giving a talk. This was like 20 years ago, obviously, because we've been best friends for 20 years. And I was like, whoa, this is a really good talk, and he's a good speaker. But after the talk, people were just gathering around you like disciples or like they just wanted you to tell them more, like what the future looks like and what you know, what's in store for them. How can I do that? How can I get people to believe whatever weird thing I say?
Well, it's easy when you steal most of your best talk ideas from Eric Meyer. That's the key. That's really the key. I stole all my good ideas from Eric Meyer and just watched a few of his talks. And he's the guy with all the vision. So
yeah, that's a good idea.
I think his Dutch accent throws people off. So all I did is I took Eric's fantastic.
It gives him credibility, I think. When I see him talk, and he sounds a little bit different, I'm like, okay, he probably knows more.
I don't know if you've ever gone to some of the really heavy-hitting functional programming conferences. There are a lot of really intelligent, well-educated Dutch computer scientists. So thank you, Dutch computer scientists mm-hmm. community.
Yeah, so that goes for all of us. Thank you, Dutch computer scientists.
We owe you a great debt.
Yeah, I'll practice that. How do you come up with the energy? How do you? What's your secret? I mean, your talks are so like, I don't know what it is. It's the time. You're like Steve Jobs of computer science.
Well, that's very kind of you. I'm legitimately super. The easy answer is to be legitimately super excited about whatever you are talking about, and not have to fake it. Reactive programming is super exciting, and it's still, I mean, it's, you know, now it's like it's everywhere, but I mean, you can only imagine how excited I was to see it for the first time, you know, at that early stage, like six, seven years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, the energy level and the excitement about it is only beginning to attenuate, and in some cases it's getting stronger because so many frameworks out there are doing reactive programming, and you know there's just so much excitement in the developer community about it, and so it's easy to get excited about.
So you think if it was a boring topic, you couldn't really get?
I'd be a terrible. Oh. I'm very bad generally at plugging stuff I don't believe in, so I try and avoid.
I don't believe that, but that's fine if you don't want to share your secret. I understand it's your trade secret. You don't want competition, but
hardly, no.
So I wanted to know a little bit more about, you know, Joffer, and so I reached out to your wife and asked her some questions, whom I know well.
Of course.
Because we used to date, and then she left me for you. So part of the reason was I wanted to understand, like, why, like, what, you know, what does he have that I don't? And so I asked a few questions. One was, does Joffer ever take a vacation? Which Kim said you don't. And so,
occasionally I do. I don't really.
Well, here's what she said.
Okay.
Yes, but he always hates it. He keeps trying to convince me that going to a conference is vacation, but you end up working the whole time.
Honey, I'm just gonna say. I think it is a vacation. You go, you do a talk, right, and then you take a few days off, and then. That's
I think she's. I think she deserves better than that.
If you're watching, honey, it counts. It totally counts.
I also asked, "What's the dumbest thing Joffer's ever done or said?" And she said, "Your pickup line was, 'I'm kind of a big deal.'"
So there's that thing.
Well, now that's out there now. I would love to say that was on a dare. Like I was going to ask the next 100 women to, and she just happened to be the first one. I was going to try that terrible pickup line, and she just totally went for it. So, joke's on you, honey. Fake it till you make it. That's what I always say, yeah. or just fake it in my case.
I asked if you have nightmares about promises.
Yeah, did she know what you meant by promise?
You know, I used capital P, so it would be clear that the promise construct. Yeah, yeah.
My wife's a dentist, so I don't know how much experience she has with JavaScript promises, but okay. what did she say to that one?
She said, only the ones that you make to her.
Right.
And I asked if you have secret ambitions to be a cult leader. Which she said is how you tricked her into marrying you, which made me feel better.
Yes. How could I steal her away?
Because, like, how could I compete with a cult leader? The charisma and the brainwashing power. So
that beard.
And finally, I asked why she chose you over me, and it was the mind control.
The mind control. Yep.
So that was really interesting. I feel like I really understand you now, and
yes.
There's a much clearer context of why you are the way you are and how things ended up this way. But I'm over it. Speaking of me, I'm really excited about Angular 2.
Yes.
You know it. I've been working on it. Everyone on the team's been working real hard on it for a while, and we're getting close to that, you know, beta.
Yep.
What do you think of it? Do you think it's the best framework yet? You've had some chances to look at it. Would you say Angular 2, from what you've seen, is the best framework ever?
I would say that Angular 2. I'll tell you what I do like about Angular 2. I think the decision to use observable for event sources is like, I think it's a fantastic decision. I think it's ahead of its time as far as frameworks go in that regard. You know, We here at Netflix use a variety of frameworks internally, but as you know, we use React externally, and I most of my experiences with React, and tell you what, when Angular 2 is released, I will at that point I will make my evaluation. I'm very excited about it. I sense a huge amount of excitement in the developer community, and so, you know, and I know quite a few people who are super excited about it. So.
What's the most important thing to you in a framework, or in the framework you choose for your projects?
Yeah, that's a good question. The most important thing for me, I think, in a framework is, one, I consider a framework to be progressive if it kind of embraces the ideas that I think are very, these new and exciting ideas that are very recent in the UI development. I think in really in just the last 2 or 3 years, we're getting to a place where we understand that we can build user interfaces, not just servers and massively scaled out servers using functional programming concepts, but we can also build user interfaces using concepts like immutability, referential transparency. And you know, I think these are really exciting new models for UI development. I'm a person who's been in UI development for 15 years, and it's amazing in just the last 2 years how this field's been revolutionized by some frameworks out there, and I think Angular would do well to take some of the great ideas that have come out from, you know, various frameworks out there and even take them, push them to the next level.
So if we do all that,
if you do all that, I'll be very excited. And
we've done everything else you've asked. When will you be happy?
I'm definitely hard to please. The jury's out. When it comes out, I'll definitely give it its fair shake.
Okay.
Well, now let's take a break and hear from one of our sponsors.
I would say that Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. Angular 2 is really exciting new models for UI development, and I'm very excited. I do like Angular 2. I think it's a fantastic framework. I'm super excited about it.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for watching. Good night.